Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Naomi Klein's new book is about capitalism, about the climate crisis, and about fighting back. We'll hear the details from Klein herself. I hope you'll stay tuned. Naomi Klein has a new book just out. It's called This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. This week and next, we'll hear sort of her condensed version of the book. A talk she gave in Montreal, Canada, on September 16, 2014. Klein was born in Montreal, into a family that was progressive and lefty for at least a couple of generations. And Naomi is doing a bang-up job of carrying on the family tradition. She's the author of a couple of very readable and highly regarded books of socio-political economic analysis. These are No Logo from 2000 and The Shock Doctrine from 2007. And now, 2014, This Changes Everything. Incidentally, there's a long excerpt from the book in the October 6 issue of The Nation magazine. It's the cover story. Your local library should have a copy. Anyway, the gist of what she is saying in the new book is something like this. Neoliberal corporate capitalism has done great damage to the environment, great damage to national economies, and great damage especially to the lives of the 99%. There are plenty of good reasons to kill this beast, and they've been around for generations. But now, this infernal economic system is rapidly killing the whole ecosphere through catastrophic climate change. The good news is that the crisis is so severe that the people may finally decide to get off of their sofas, fight back, and make some much-needed sweeping changes. Klein says that any remotely plausible attempt to prevent climate catastrophe will have to undercut some of the four pillars of neoliberal capitalist doctrine. These pillars are privatization, deregulation, cuts to government spending, and so-called free trade agreements. All four are evil disasters, so smashing these four anti-democratic oppressive forces is a much stronger possibility now than it was, say, 10 years ago. Several people we've heard on this show also have said, with Naomi Klein, that capitalism leads to climate catastrophe. Noam Chomsky, and Chris Hedges, and Guy McPherson, to name just three. But in this gloomy group, Klein is the real optimist. Capitalism is not going to kill us, she says. The climate crisis is going to motivate us to kill capitalism. Or if not kill it, at least give it a good kick in a painful place and knock it off its throne. Well, we'll see. Recorded live in Montreal, September 16, here is Naomi Klein.
So I start the book by confessing that I used to be a climate change denier. And when I say that, I don't mean a climate change denier like, you know, Donald Trump or the Tea Party and the people who you say, like, because winter exists, climate change must not be real. But, you know, that's hard denial, and I've hung around with those people, and I have a chapter of the book about them and how they think and why they deny climate change. But in many ways, I think that those deniers get too much attention. And frankly, I think we should sort of ignore them. We're not going to win them over. They're denying climate change because it threatens their worldview. They understand that in order to respond to climate change, it does require challenging capitalism. And therefore, it must not be real. because capitalism and belief in free markets is so central to their core that it's unthinkable to imagine that it could be true, that this economic system could be destabilizing life on Earth. So the scientists must be part of a huge conspiracy. So that's them, and we can understand them. But I'm more interested in how the rest of us deny climate change, and I include myself in this. I think we all deny climate change because it's unbearable. It's unbearable to hold the idea in our head continuously that we are part of a system, that our actions are part of a system that is waging war on life on Earth. And it's particularly hard to look because we are in a culture that is acting as if this is not happening. So on the one hand, we catch a glimpse of a news article telling us, you know, the Arctic ice is melting and ever more apocalyptic warnings from the IPCC, from climate scientists, you know, from every scientific organization in the world saying, you know, please listen. And then we turn on, you know, the television and we hear about the Energy East Pipeline or Line 9 or Northern Gateway or Kinder Morgan or a new fracking frontier or drilling in the Arctic. So it isn't like our politicians are doing nothing. They are hurtling down the wrong road. So how do we reconcile these completely contradictory thoughts, these completely contradictory ideas? We start telling ourselves stories like, well, you know, it must not be that big a problem after all, or the environmentalists are dealing with it, or we must have more time, or there's going to be some techno fix that's going to bail us out at the last minute. You know, humans are very clever. This is what we do. And these are the stories we tell ourselves. Or we just tell ourselves we're focused on more immediate concerns, right? You know, we can't focus on something so far off, even though we know that climate change isn't far off. We saw the water in the subways in New York. We saw the people on their rooftops in New Orleans holding signs that said, help, we've experienced it in our own lives with more and more weird, strange weather. Maybe we tell ourselves that all we can do is change ourselves. You know, we can meditate and we can change our lifestyle and sort of turn our personal life into a piece of low-carbon performance art. But as far as engaging with the system that is taking us down that road, well, you know, that's a lot of kind of bad energy and there's no point in doing that anyway. And these are the stories we tell ourselves. And I don't want to belittle those important actions that we take as individuals. But I think if that's all we do, that is also a form of looking away, even though it may look like we're looking very hard. So the argument I'm making in the book is that we'll never be able to look all the time. It's just too hard. But we need to give it a good long look. We need to focus on those stories that we have been clicking past, choosing not to read, looking away from and saying, I just can't handle this today. We need to look and we need to absorb what 97% of climate scientists are telling us. And we need to find ways to form community with one another to actually feel the grief and the loss that comes along with that. Because it is an emotional process. You know, environmentalists, they have this model of change that is like a lot of environmentalists, okay, not all environmentalists, have been accused of generalizing. So I will say that some of the big green groups sort of have this theory of change that involves like, okay, I'm going to scare the hell out of people and then they're going to become activists, right? And that's not actually how we change. You know, you scare the hell out of people, tell them the world is ending, they actually want to curl up in a ball, especially if they're getting that news alone at home in a direct mail or on an email blast or on television. So we have to find ways to support each other in community. And being here in Montreal reminds me of growing up in the feminist movement with my mom and her friends at Studio D. You know, they would show films in our living room and cry. but you know, film was this, it was an emotional, I grew up with this idea of social change being an emotional process that we support each other through. You don't challenge people's worldview and say, see ya, hope it goes well, go become an activist. You have to stick around to pick up the pieces. So we need to acknowledge that sharing this news has emotional ramifications for people. But we need to look. And we need to look because I think that if we allow ourselves to feel the terror that comes with this news and the urgency of the timelines we are on, just how short the time is. You know, people have started calling this decade zero for climate action. We either act within the next 5 years because we're halfway through this decade, or we are locking in catastrophic climate change for generations to come. So if we absorb the urgency, it becomes clear, as Gabrielle alluded to, that only radical change has a chance of averting catastrophe in time. And that's because we've waited so long. You know, since governments started coming together to talk about climate change in the early 90s, emissions, global emissions, have gone up by 61%, right? So it's not like, you know, sometimes we talk about how we're not doing anything. It's much worse than that. If we were doing nothing, it would be static. But the issue is that our greenhouse gas emissions have been increasing year after year, and those emissions stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So there is what Michael Mann, the famed climate scientist at Penn State University, calls a procrastination penalty, which means that if we had started in 1990, as we were supposed to, then we could have reduced our emissions gradually. But because we didn't, we now have to reduce our emissions rather suddenly, by 10% a year, starting now. And the problem with that is that it is incompatible with the logic of mindless economic growth of the sort that Stephen Harper is always talking about and using as an excuse for why there can be no climate action, because he understands this. He understands that there is a fundamental conflict between that economic model and taking science seriously. Now, for someone like Stephen Harper, who is committed to defending that ideology, those set of interests that created that ideology, obviously, climate science is pretty terrifying. But if you think there's something wrong with that economic system for a whole lot of other reasons, some of which we heard tonight, because they are waging war not only on the climate system, but also on our social programs, the education system, the healthcare system, our public infrastructure, our sense of community, our health, then the fact that this is also waging war on the planet's life support systems would seem to be an extra good reason to change it. I believe that climate change presents us with a once-in-a-century opportunity to transform the global economy for the better, to turn the world right side up. It demands that we invest massively in the public sphere, because, of course, we have to protect ourselves for the weather, the heavy weather we've already locked in, and we need huge public works projects to roll out the renewable energy economy that is within our grasp. The technology is there. You know, we know that it's doable, but it takes huge public expenditure to do it. As does it take to build the public transit systems and the light rail systems that we need. So we need to invest in the public sphere. We need to invest in science education. We need to invest in science generally. It presents us with an opportunity to create huge numbers of jobs. A dollar, if you take a dollar spent in the oil and gas industry and divert it into energy efficiency, renewable energy, public transit, it creates 7 to 8 times as many jobs. So it's not a choice between jobs and the environment. It's a choice between mindless growth and the environment. But there are more jobs if we take this route. It requires that we tackle some of the most persistent and institutionalized forms of injustice within our countries and between our countries, systems of racism and colonialism that have wounded our world for too long. It requires that we build a fairer world. And that is because some of the largest pools of carbon left are under the lands of some of the poorest people in the world. And unless there's justice, there will be climate change. The environmental crisis, if conceived sufficiently broadly, neither trumps nor distracts from our most pressing political and economic causes. On the contrary, it supercharges each of them with existential urgency, and it puts us on a firm and unyielding deadline. Now, as I said, I think our political elites understand this well, which is why they either deny climate change or propose false solutions, whether it's voluntary agreements between CEOs who get together at gatherings like the one that's going to be taking place in New York next week at the United Nations. The UN has called the summit, but it's clear that the leaders aren't taking this seriously. But they're saying, well, don't worry about that because we have, you know, dozens of CEOs from companies like Bank of America and Suez, a major water privatizer, that are going to come together and solve this crisis for us. In other words, rather than getting the polluters to pay for this crisis, we are turning to the polluters to solve it for us. And I think that will go about as well as bringing the banks together to regulate themselves. So they propose these false solutions precisely because they are afraid of the real solutions. And some of those false solutions increasingly are techno fixes on a global scale, sometimes called geoengineering, the idea that, you know, rather than cutting our emissions, we will spray a sulfur into the stratosphere and dim the sun and cool the planet down. And what could possibly go wrong there? But the more we fail to get at the root causes of this crisis, which is the pollution, the more these false solutions will be trumpeted and be presented as reasonable and serious. So the solution to pollution is now, it turns out, pollution. So in the book, I make the argument that the reason we have failed to rise to the challenge presented to us by climate change is not any of the usual explanations that we so often hear, like that humans are greedy, you know, that it's human nature not to want to tackle a far-off threat, even though this threat is anything but far-off, as I said, and even though there are many precedents in history of humans coming together in the face of threats that are not immediate. Or we're told that it's just simply too complicated for governments to come together and come up with a rule, you know, for the entire world, even though we've done it before. And there was just a report about the Montreal Protocol on ozone depletion, which actually has been an incredible success, and the ozone layer is healing because of decisions made in Montreal in 1987 when governments came together and decided to phase out the substances that were causing the hole in the ozone layer. You know, and it is true that banning, you know, hairspray is easier than banning oil, right? But it's also true that as time went on, the timing for this crisis got worse. You know, that was 1987. 1988 was the year that there was the first gathering of governments to tackle emission reductions. So I would say, you know, what else was happening in 1988? Well, let's think about it. Well, the first free trade deal was being signed between Canada and the United States. The year after that, 1989, was the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Francis Fukuyama was declaring history over. So this issue landed on our laps, you know, and this was the point after which there could be no plausible deniability. This was the moment where the scientific consensus really hit the mainstream. This was the moment when Time magazine had to choose a man of the year, and they chose Planet Earth. This was our window, and yet it happened at the most triumphant moment for neoliberal orthodoxy, when this ideology was being spread around the world, when regulation became a dirty word, when austerity policies were introduced in force around the world. So what I do in the book is show in concrete ways how doing the things we must do to respond to climate change clash directly with the pillars of neoliberalism, being privatization, deregulation, cuts to government spending, or austerity, and also free trade, the logic of free trade and the signing of ever more free trade deals, of which we've just apparently signed one with China. So I'll give a few examples of how this clash plays out. I live in Toronto. Ontario had a pretty good green energy program, introduced amazingly enough by the Liberal government. And it had very ambitious targets. It was introduced in the midst of the economic crisis in 2009 because the auto industry was collapsing. And part of what allowed this plan to be sold, of setting very ambitious targets for phasing out coal, was that it would be an answer to the jobs crisis. And so in addition to introducing a feed-in tariff and providing incentives for renewable energy and for people to be able to benefit from basically subsidized energy, anybody who became an energy provider had to commit to a certain amount of local production. 40% to 60% of the solar panels and the wind turbines had to be made in Ontario. So it was a combination of a climate policy and a job program. And it got buy-in from the trade unions, and it was a popular policy, and it was working. It created 31,000 manufacturing jobs. We started to see manufacturers move to Ontario because this market had been created. Well, a couple years later, Japan and then the European Union took Canada to the World Trade Organization and challenged this policy on the grounds that it violated Canada's obligations under the World Trade Organization not to discriminate against foreign companies. It was unfair to Japanese and European solar and wind turbine makers to have this buy local requirement. And they won. The WTO ruled that the Ontario plan was illegal. So your trade trumped the climate, even though this was a very successful trade policy. And this has been happening again and again. The U.S. took China to the WTO. They took India to the WTO. Both China and India are threatening retaliation. So at this moment, when we should be rolling out the most ambitious renewable energy programs possible, we are instead going to the World Trade Organization and trying to knock down each other's windmills, which is kind of crazy. The other way this is happening is that when you have a success like the shale gas moratorium here in Quebec, a hard-won political success, that also is vulnerable to challenges under free trade rules. And in fact, there's a U.S.-registered company, not actually an American company, that is challenging the shale gas moratorium, Quebec's shale gas moratorium, under NAFTA, and saying that this unfairly robs it of its right to drill under the St. Lawrence. And TransCanada is making noises saying that if Obama does, in the end, nix the Keystone XL pipeline, that there could be a trade retaliation. Like, what right does the U.S. have to say no to this pipeline? And this, of course, is the fear of the Canada-China free trade deal, would be that if we do manage to stop something like the Northern Gateway pipeline, and I believe we will stop the Northern Gateway pipeline, then China could potentially challenge that under that free trade deal. So that's a pretty straight-up clash between neoliberalism and what we need to do to address the climate crisis. The other most obvious one I alluded to earlier, which is just the basic clash between the logic of austerity, the endless cuts to the public sphere, and what we need to do in response to this crisis. And this came to a head in the UK in an interesting way during a season of terrible flooding a year ago, where David Cameron, sort of Mr. Austerity himself, was caught kind of flat-footed because he had gutted the agency that was responsible for flood defense in the UK. They had nixed hundreds of flood defense programs. More than 1,000 people had been laid off. Another 1,000 were on the chopping block. And people started to make the connection. Wait a minute. Large parts of Britain are underwater. We really need help. How smart is it at this point in history when the climate scientists are telling us we're going to see more and more events like this to be hacking away at the public services that we need most? And it was interesting because Cameron was so under siege in this moment that he very famously said that money was no object, that he would spend whatever was necessary, because he saw that there was a real political cost in that moment. So crisis does that. And the question is whether that could be leveraged in a moment of crisis, when there's a storm or when there's flooding, but whether the crisis of climate change more broadly could be used to challenge the austerity agenda. And I think it can, and I think it can also be used to challenge the free trade agenda. I think we should have been talking about that much more in the context of the China deal and also in the context of the European free trade deal. It cannot be illegal to protect our planet, but that is precisely what these deals are locking in. So the other thing that happened in the UK in the midst of that flooding is, so there was this call, okay, Cameron has to spend whatever it takes to save these communities that are underwater, that have lost electricity, that have lost rail access. But the Daily Mail, which is a very right-wing tabloid in the UK, launched this petition, and the petition called on the British government to divert money that was slotted for foreign aid and use it to help flood victims at home. So it was this very xenophobic response, right? Why are we helping those poor people of color in other countries when our own are underwater, right? And it got hundreds of thousands of signatures. This is the ugly side of how we respond to climate change if it is locked within this mentality of false scarcity. And in fact, we're seeing this writ large, where if we are to unlock the climate deadlock, there have to be transfers of resources, technology, of wealth from the global north to the global south, because this is a crisis that was created in the global north. We have a 200-year head start on emissions. As I said, emissions build up, and yet the effects of climate change are overwhelmingly being felt in the poorest countries. If they are going to develop, they're going to leapfrog over fossil fuels, there has to be that income redistribution. But of course, that's off the table. We're told that within the logic of endless economic crisis, we can't even talk about increasing foreign aid, let alone talking about climate justice and climate debt. So this is another way in which the logic has to be challenged.
Naomi Klein. Her new book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. I have lightly edited the recording for radio. Thanks to community radio station CKUT in Montreal for the original recording. We'll hear the rest of her talk and more next week. So, by all means, please tune in again to New World Notes. We come to you from the East of the River Satellite Studio and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You'll find a free archive of our past shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum. Please keep in mind that an injury to one is an injury to all. And remember, you are not alone. Ciao.